I'd like to welcome everybody. We really look forward to this program and worked really hard to integrate some of what we know. We can't cover everything in an hour. As you can see, I've worked a long time in the field. The proof of it is, I think I've received recently 3 Lifetime Achievement Awards, which my wife finds very depressing, meaning that I've worked in the field almost continuously since 1972. My first publication in the field was in 72 on amphetamines, and the last time I was here at ACP, we were talking about tobacco smoke and secondhand smoke, but today it's pain and opioids. And I'm joined by Steve Stanos, who's an expert in pain and worked very hard to develop pain guidelines, and is an absolute pleasure to be with, and thank you for coming in. It's a long way from Seattle. But I'm sure everybody really appreciates it. What are our objections? Thank you. I don't object to you taking pictures. What are our learning objectives? Recognize the growing burden of the opioid epidemic and the role of all stakeholders in the community. 2, apply knowledge of acute and chronic pain pathways and underlying mechanisms to clinical assessment and appropriate management. 3, upon evaluation of current clinical workflow for opioid prescribing, incorporate 2 best practice strategies to optimize safe and competent prescribing and minimize potential for abuse and diversion. And lastly, educate patients about their pain to optimize safe and effective multimodality treatment plans and programs. I'll start with what's obvious to anyone that reads any of the literature, which is that we have an opioid crisis. We've had this for a while, and it now affects all ages. It's actually morphed, and we're in the third phase of the crisis. The first phase was identified by Ted Cicero at Washington University in St. Louis, and in a publication in the New England Journal of Medicine, basically said that we were in a prescription opioid crisis because of a variety of factors, some of which we'll have time to talk about, and that that crisis had morphed from prescription opioids to heroin, and now we're in the third phase, which is the synthetic opioid phase, the fentanyl phase. And there are papers describing each of these phases, but the bottom line is deaths have continued to increase. This is a particularly helpful paper, I think, from the journal Science, which says that really, it's not that we have a brand new epidemic, it's that we have a continuing drug use crisis with overdoses now dominating the field. But when I first started at Yale in the mid-70s, we had an opioid crisis, and those opioids tended to come from Southeast Asia, from Vietnam veterans and others, and we did use Narcan. We had overdoses. I actually led the team that invented the use of clonidine or catapress for acute opioid withdrawal and for analgesic potentiation, and used clonidine and naltrexone both at that time in 76. We had a problem. We didn't have the death problem. That's increased as we move from prescription opioids, which actually have the milligram numbers on them, to illicit opioids like heroin, which doesn't and has varying compositions depending on state and locale and time, to the current one, which has so many synthetics added that the deaths you see spike as a result. So there's the 3 phases, and heroin, then the second phase, and then the synthetic opioids, with fentanyl being the drug that's been identified the most. In addition to the opioid overdose deaths and the opioid use disorder increases that have been reported, there are a whole host of other problems that the CDC and others have highlighted that are summarized on this particular slide, and they'll be well known to you. The cardiovascular disease consequences and endocarditis summarized by a variety of authors, including Daniel Blumenthal at Massachusetts General Hospital. the HIV infection increases and viral hepatitis increases, which have been reported most recently by the CDC. And there are also just horrific effects on family and children left alone and on overall functioning and loss of productivity. When they add them all together, that's the opioid crisis that we're in right now.
Thanks, Mark. I'm Steve Stanis. It's great to be here. I'm a physiatrist and a pain medicine specialist. Like Mark explained, I work in Seattle. I run pain services for a hospital system. And so our pain clinic has medication management, addiction treatment. We also do pain rehabilitation with physical therapy, psychology. So my background is trying to look at the whole patient and trying to understand chronic pain. Is pain something that's really easy to treat? Is it really easy to explain to your patients what pain is? Okay, so my goal here in the next 30, 40 minutes will be to help kind of update you on our knowledge about pain. If you think about it, and we're gonna try to touch upon this, just trying to explain to someone the physiology of pain in itself is so complex, and so we're gonna try to spend time putting that together, because if we're gonna do a better job of treating pain, like Mark alluded to with regards to the opioid epidemic and really this other issue around problems with undertreatment of pain and poor kind of comprehensive pain management, we really need to understand that the complexity of pain. The National Health Interview Survey, it came out this past year, and the NHIS is a questionnaire survey that goes out to like 30,000 people a year. And that's where the government gets most of its data on epidemiology of a number of conditions. In this case, they looked at pain. And pain, in many years, we've talked about what the prevalence is, and it's always been difficult because were those people that are surveyed, do they have medical treatment, or are they just complaining of pain but still living their life? And what their numbers showed was that 50 million Americans reported chronic pain, and that's pain on most days or every day in the last 6 months. The interesting part was the next question, and the National Pain Strategy came out in 2011 that led to other government transformative projects to look at better treatment of pain, and we defined this term called high-impact chronic pain. High-impact chronic pain is chronic pain that limits life, worked activities on most days of the week or every day during the past 6 months. And I think that actually does a better job of identifying mostly those patients that we are seeing in clinic or we're seeing it in the hospital with pain. And the interesting part, the numbers were 20 million, that's 1 in 12 Americans with high-impact chronic pain. And so now, over the next number of years, there'll be more questions, and I think from a society level, we'll have a lot better understanding. But I think it underscores not just the issue with the heroin and opioid overdose epidemic, but this issue around better treatment of pain. Other surveys have shown that there's 90 million Americans prescribed opioids, 2 million individuals with a diagnosis of opioid use disorder. How many of those do you think are treated effectively? Almost only 20% actually are receiving buprenorphine or medications for opioid use disorder, and even a smaller percentage, behavioral interventions. So there's definitely a lot of work to do on the pain management side as well on the addiction side to helping patients. So what is pain? And pain, I would think of as what's been described as a threat to the biologic integrity of a person. It's an important warning signal, right? And we can imagine if we stubbed our toe this morning, that would probably hurt. And after a couple minutes, we'd swear or do something else, and the pain would go away, right? That's a warning system that's normal and important to our physiologic responses. Suffering is a little different, and suffering was brought into, I think, the understanding of the medical community by Casale a number of years ago, who described this chronic distress that affects the intactness of the person. And so it's not just the physiology or that physical dimension of pain, but how pain affects how people interact, their roles in society, their depression and anxiety. So most of us as clinicians, we ask our patients their pain score, right? And what do they say? 9 out of 10, and they stare at you. So really, it's that pain score, even though it's useful, is probably their suffering score, because what is that pain actually doing to them? Okay, so that's gonna be important as we do a better job of understanding pain. The one thing I did want to mention, we don't have a lot of time to go through about depression and anxiety, but with chronic pain, I think we can all agree there's significant depression and anxiety, and there's behavioral causes of that, as well as neurochemical. I wanted to just touch upon another psychosocial factor that sometimes is forgotten, and that's catastrophizing. Catastrophizing is a tendency to ruminate and focus excessively on pain. And so it includes magnification, helplessness. Many of our patients have catastrophic thinking. That catastrophic thinking is gonna do what? Do you think it's gonna help their pain treatment? Is it gonna make it more of a challenge to help them? Or are we going to use catastrophic thinking as a focus of behavioral interventions or education about pain? So again, we know catastrophizing is important. It affects patients' physical disability and mental well-being. And again, it's mostly a target of cognitive behavioral therapy as well as counseling. And there's been a number of studies showing improving pain decreasing shows decreases on functional MRI in the brain where these catastrophic areas are lit up. So again, this is going to be important not just to think of depression and anxiety, but I wanted to mention catastrophizing. So if we think about pain, pain is not just some simple sensory phenomena, right? It's an output of the brain, but it's not just a representation of the magnitude of stimuli. So think about one person that gets hit in the elbow, another person gets hit in the elbow, the same amount of tissue trauma, they could have significantly different response to pain, right? One person could develop, could recover in a couple days, the other person could develop chronic pain from the same injury. So we know that pain's a lot more, you know, the brain has, it's bidirectional. The brain is helping with that output, but it's impacted by a patient's cognitions, their context or beliefs about pain, their mood, so high depression, high anxiety. Do you think that's gonna help increase or decrease pain? That'll increase pain. Chemical and structural changes, there's been a number of studies showing just chronic pain itself causes degeneration of key areas of the brain that also can cause facilitation of pain response. And we know there's also genetic susceptibility with pain responses as well. So this is a lot more complex than just a sensory phenomena, and we're hopefully gonna do this in the next 20 minutes to give you a better understanding of that. So what we thought was gonna be interesting here, and I'm excited about, I think Mark's excited about, is we've developed these pain pathways and we've brought them to life with augmented reality. So this is super cool. We hope this will be an easier way for you to understand some of those differences between nociceptive pain, neuropathic pain, and a newer term, nociplastic pain. So this is Phil, because we're in Philly. He's got, he's working, but not in his underwear, but just for the sake of our example here. He's working as a construction worker. He's got normal pain processing. If he was injured, nociceptors would be activated that would cause a warning system to light up in the body. Right now, he's walking around, he's fine. There, if he rubbed his arm, the large fibers would be stimulated. Now he gets hit. So now his C and A delta fibers, or pain fibers, have been activated. Because of that trauma in the skin, and say in the elbow in this region, that's gonna cause transduction of stimuli from the skin and those receptors. They're gonna be conducted along electrical activity to the brain, to the spinal cord and up to the brain. And so that's gonna involve irritation and inflammation in the periphery. It's gonna involve changes at the spinal cord that are gonna cause transmission to the brain. And then the brain is gonna react. The brain could cause, you know, based on cognitions and emotions, increases or decreases in that pain response. And so very complex. There's chemicals that are released. So substance P, glutamate, inflammatory chemicals in the joint can cause sodium conduction along the nerves to the spinal cord. That may involve calcium modulation where there's sensitization of the nervous system. And then all of these complex changes at the brain level. So a lot of our medications and our interventions are gonna be focused on affecting those neurochemical changes and affecting the behavioral changes. So again, very complex changes, and that's why just targeting one mechanism of action is usually not gonna wipe out pain signals because it's so complex. So we're gonna use the next three examples here to talk about the different types of pain. So our first example is neuropathic pain. So neuropathic pain can be postherpetic neuralgia, diabetic neuropathy. Here we're using a spine model, and in the spine, we've got the disc. The disc is now herniated. It's releasing chemicals. It's gonna happen here in a second. Those chemicals are gonna cause increased conduction of action potentials. It's gonna cause other neurochemical changes. They're gonna go to the brain, signaling pain. And there's also gonna be descending information from the nerve root. And that nerve root is gonna cause ectopic activity. So there could be paresthesias, which is a non-painful stimulation, like radiating leg pain, or a dysesthesia, where there's a painful sensation going down the leg. And that's all from conduction along these nerve roots and irritation of the nerve. Okay, so our focus of medications will be at trying to decrease excitation, some of those neurochemical changes. Okay, so that's one example of neuropathic pain. All others could include post-stroke pain, multiple sclerosis. Okay, so there's significant changes just from that disc pushing on the nerve. Okay, Now we're going to talk about nociceptive pain. So nociceptive pain is primarily, there's activation of nociceptors that are a signal of threatening damage to tissue. So in this example, we've got an inflammation of the metacarpal and the PIP joints. Those joints are inflamed. That's going to cause inflammation, bradykinin, neurochemicals are released. That's also going to cause other macrophages that are released, causing excitation. And that signal is then going to go to the spinal cord, to the nerves along the hand, to the spinal cord, and to the brain. And so a lot of our medications like anti-inflammatories and other chemicals are going to be used to try to block that signal. Now, the interesting part is with even joint pain or nociceptive pain, that ongoing input, if it doesn't go away, can cause the whole nervous system to be sensitized. Okay, so many patients may have inflammation of a joint, the inflammation goes away, and they get better. Other patients with prolonged inflammation, that inflammation, is that peripheral input, causes changes at the spinal cord in the brain called central sensitization. And that can lead to more complex pain response. And again, other targets for us when we think of medications and other interventions. So the last group we're going to talk about is nociplastic. And nociplastic was described a number of years ago as called hypersensitization or central sensitization. It was defined by the International Association for the Study of Pain in the last year. With nociplastic pain, there's nociceptors are activated, but there's no threat or tissue damage along nerve tissues or the like. And so it's really the nociceptors are activated and we're not sure why. There's some type of sensitization. Okay, so examples of that here like our irritable bowel syndrome. If you think of IBS, IBS can cause really a visceral sensitization where there's changes, where there's increase in serotonin, chloride channels, all sorts of changes from this visceral input that leads to sensitization. And if you think about IBS, patients with IBS also have high prevalence of fibromyalgia and other central pain conditions. And that's because of this kind of sensitization of their tissues, not just in the gut, but causing sensitization in the nervous system. So that's nociplastic pain. Okay, and other examples of nociplastic pain include fibromyalgia. Like I said, I think it's probably the easiest, tension-type headache, interstitial cystitis. Okay, so remember, we've got three different types. We have nociceptive, neuropathic, and this hypersensitivity-type pain condition described as nociplastic pain. Okay, nociplastic is really a central pain phenomena. And we're going to talk about, just from a mechanism standpoint, if we're using medications, right, where do we use the medications? Do we think of the periphery? So in the periphery, there's trauma. We may use local anesthetics. We may use NSAIDs or COX-2 inhibitors to decrease changes with prostaglandins in tissue injury. Then moving along the dorsal horn and the spinal roots, local anesthetics affecting calcium like gabapentin, pregabalin, trying to decrease calcium modulation. And many of the anticonvulsants that we use are decreasing sensitization of these chemicals. At the dorsal horn in the brain, also opioids can be used. Opioids help to decrease substance P and glutamate by decreasing pain signals. And then even up at the brain level, we also have the alpha agonists, the centrally acting analgesics, serotonin, norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. All of those are individually focused on different mechanisms of action to help decrease sensitization. Now, with that in mind, when you give a medication to somebody, does their pain go away? I mean, most billion-dollar drugs usually drop their pain 1 to 2 points. And that underscores the complexity of the nervous system. And the medications we're using are just really doing a small amount. And so many times, we have to have patients on multiple medications that are going to help with those mechanisms and also use non-pharmacologic interventions to quiet down the nervous system. So if we look at patients and we look at applying a biopsychosocial model, because really pain is, in the past, we thought of pain as a biomedical model, that if you identify the tissue damage and you focus on the tissue damage and treat that, the pain's going to go away. Well, the biomedical model may work for acute pain, but for chronic pain, because there's so many different changes, changes in the periphery, changes at the spinal cord in the brain, it's really a biopsychosocial problem. And so if you think about when you're effectively treating patients, you're not just focusing on the medications, but what are the behavioral interventions? What are exercise and these other interventions that can really help patients? So when we look at applying this biopsychosocial approach, the physical exam is going to be important. Many of our patients have more than one underlying pain condition. They may have joint pain. They may have myofascial pain. You know, so a good physical exam will help kind of clue you in to what you need to focus on. What tools are you going to use? Are you going to use a pain score? Are you going to use other functional scores? Are you going to assess their depression and anxiety to get a better understanding of the patient? So psychosocial assessment, there's many different tools you can use. Commonly, the GAD-7 is used for anxiety, the PHQ-9 for depression. There's also catastrophizing scales, there's disability scales that also can clue you into what's happening with your patient, as well as a psychological evaluation by a counselor or a PhD. There's also tools we can use to predict aberrant behaviors. So aberrant behaviors primarily were thought to be used to describe patients on opioids to figure out what are those risk factors that may predict addiction or misuse of medicines. But really, that is really just a good social history, you know, looking at those risk factors like depression, anxiety, previous substance abuse. And we'll talk about some tools that you can use that will help you to risk stratify your patients. The PEG is another one that's been commonly used. I practice in the state of Washington, and our new pain rules state that you don't just ask pain rules, pain scores. You have to have some type of validated measure for function. So PEG is very easy. It's three questions for 0 to 10, pain, E for enjoyment in life, and G for general activity. And we can look across our patients, all of their pain interviews, they give their PEG scores. So we can look at those three domains, and we can assess those over time. So we're not saying the pain score isn't important, but we're also looking at enjoyment of life and their general activity. So for risk stratifying, it's really not just something you should consider with chronic pain, but even acute pain. I mean, think about some of the patients you have now that have a high depression and anxiety, very catastrophic types of thinking. When they get injured or they present with you in pain, do you think they're at higher risk? And so the good thing is many times internists and primary care providers know these patients before they developed acute pain. So doing that risk assessment is going to be key. Okay, so also looking at aberrant behaviors, which we're going to show you a tool that's commonly being used, but also looking at medications and medical conditions. If you think of opioids themselves, what would be a risk factor for opioid overdose? Medical conditions like COPD, you know, other pulmonary issues, sleep apnea, separate from, you know, depression and anxiety. Okay, so also thinking about what medications could put you at risk. Benzodiazepines, you know, other centrally acting agents could also put you at risk for aberrant behaviors or problems with medications. Okay, so the complexity of this assessing risk is going to be key, but really looking at your patients in a biopsychosocial manner. So the opioid risk tool is a common tool that's been validated. Dr. Webster put this together a number of years ago, and it's a tool that predicts aberrant behavior. And so you can use this and to help stratify your patients at their level of risk for developing aberrant behaviors. And the idea being, the more aberrant behaviors you have, maybe that's a clue that there's an addiction problem or a substance use problem going on. And so the opioid risk tool is based on five different questions: a family history of substance abuse, a personal history of substance abuse, age, and there's a higher risk for aberrant behaviors between 16 and 45. Not that those that are over than 45 aren't at risk, but we know that younger people, it's higher risk. History of pre-adolescent sexual abuse. When was the last time you asked your patients if they had that history? Do you think that would impact their response to pain? Yes. And psychologic disease. So the patients fill this out, or the clinician can ask these questions. There's a slightly different scoring with whether you're female or male, and then it scores at either low, moderate, or high risk for aberrant behaviors. And in our state, we use this tool to determine how frequently we're going to do urine screens. So the low-risk patient, maybe you would do a urine screen once a year, versus the high-risk patient, you would be doing it at least every quarter. And so again, it gives you an idea of their risk for aberrant behaviors. And this is actually showing from a study of close to 300 patients in a treatment center for substance abuse disorders. They had four times higher rate of emotional and sexual abuse than those in the control group. And so again, in our clinic, many times this is the first time patients have been asked about pre-adolescent sexual abuse or even psychological abuse. And identifying that early on can also help impact how you treat patients and the other tools that you may need to use to help patients get better. So the next part, this is actually just kind of giving a nice summary of what are your pain management tools. And we can think of medications, but medications many times really just doing a small part of your intervention. So medications, again, thinking about the mechanisms and maybe using multiple medications to affect multiple mechanisms that are impacted. Behavioral medicine, so cognitive behavioral therapy, looking at thoughts, emotions, coping strategies, mindfulness, teaching patients to be in the moment, kind of separating the physical feeling of pain from the emotional and cognitive effects. And so mindfulness can also be taught to patients by a psychologist or a counselor. Relaxation training, we teach patients deep breathing, progressive muscle relaxation, and those are ways they're taught to control their body and decrease their stress. Okay. Physical modalities and interventions, physical therapy, occupational therapy, modalities, interventional procedures. So our patient with radiculopathy or the spine that had compression of the nerve root and nerve irritation, maybe an epidural injection could help that patient decrease inflammation around the nerve root. And physical therapy would help increase strengthening in their core muscles. Okay. And then monitoring and education, very important. And in our program, our pain rehabilitation program, we do a lot of education guided by our nurse educator, and it's the strongest feedback we get from our patients is the education and how much that helped them. Do you think patients with maladaptive thoughts that continue to have maladaptive thoughts about their body are going to continue to have problems? Yes. And so teaching them about their body, teaching them about sleep hygiene, teaching them about stress and how that affects their body, how their diet affects their pain, all of those things can be important as well. So for best practices for chronic pain, we wanted to present one case or two cases. The first case is a 64-year-old administrative assistant with knee osteoarthritis. She's obese. She's got cardiovascular disease. She's a candidate for knee replacement. But the surgeon would like her to try to lose weight first. Do you think that's going to be easy for the patient? So she sees the surgeon, and he says, oh, you've got the worst x-ray I've ever seen, right? They're always told it's the worst x-ray they've ever seen. but I can't do your surgery until you lose 50 pounds. And then they come back to you at the primary care clinic. And then what do you do? Throw your hands up? No. Okay, so what are we going to do for this patient? She hasn't improved on NSAIDs or topical analgesics. She had a knee injection with steroids, and it gave her 2 days of pain relief. So do you have a lot of options here? Okay, and this is, you're 20 minutes behind or 2 hours behind in clinic. Okay, so what are our choices? So now, what would you recommend for Mrs. Jasper? Oxycodone, 5 milligrams, acetaminophen 325, 1 every 4 to 6 hours. 2, continue with knee injections every 3 months. Prescribe gabapentin, NSAIDs, and acetaminophen. So give her 3 scripts and tell her to come back in a month. Continue on their weight loss program, or I'm not sure.
Please pick.
Please pick one of those on your iPad there, sorry. You don't have Eye of the Tiger playing in the background of your clinic. So. Okay, so the most common was 60% said prescribe gabapentin. Now, gabapentin is approved for postherpetic neuralgia, so that would be off-label use. NSAIDs, maybe you would try a higher dose of NSAID, and maybe acetaminophen at a higher dose. That's a possibility. 23% said continue on the weight loss program, so maybe get her in pool therapy, get her to bariatric clinic or other educational things about weight. Some said not sure. And 9% said start oxycodone. So she's already failed anti-inflammatories, she's failed topicals and knee injections. Maybe she is a candidate for opioids in this case. But would you need to screen her for risk of aberrant behaviors? Would you want to be careful in really doing a good assessment of this patient before you even started her on opioid therapy? Okay, so again, there's no really right answer here. We just wanted to underscore the complexity of these patients. So related to opioids, we wanted to spend time going over the CDC guideline. Are you guys familiar with the CDC guideline for opioids? So the CDC guideline came out in 2016. It's based on the best available evidence at that time. There were 12 recommendations, and we'll go through the highlight of those recommendations. They specifically stated, though, in the CDC guideline that the clinical decision-making should be based on a relationship between the patient and the clinician and an understanding of the patient's individual situation. Right? So this really isn't just based on what their morphine equivalent is, but really understanding what's going on with that patient. Okay, and the recommendations were voluntary rather than prescriptive standards. I think, unfortunately, since these guidelines have come out, most insurance companies and other groups have really been using this as standard of care. So it's really important if you're prescribing opioids to be familiar with the CDC guideline. So we're going to go through the guideline. Again, there were 12 recommendations. The recommendations were broken down into 3 areas. When to determine the need for opioids, opioid selection, dosage, and duration of therapy. And the final four or five recommendations were on assessing risk and addressing harm. And a lot of these recommendations were based on things that we've been talking about for the last 10 and 20 years. But the nice thing about the CDC that was put together in one document, there's actually very good resources if you go to the website. I, again, explain to any physician that's prescribing medications and opioids to spend 20 minutes, 15 minutes reading through these recommendations. Most state guidelines are based on the CDC. So a lot of this is probably pretty familiar to you. So the first recommendation was determining need for opioids. Opioids are not the first line. So in this patient, she failed other medications. So if we were going to use opioids, maybe she is considered now. Establish and measure goals of pain and function, and then to discuss the risk benefits of opioid therapy. What are her goals? She's having trouble with her knee pain. She's not getting out of the house. If we're going to give you this medicine, what are two or three things you want to do that you're having trouble with now that if we can get your pain down, you can be more functional? So really linking your medication and your recommendations for treatment with a specific goal for the patient. It also states to use immediate release opioids when starting treatment. Start low and go slow. This was part of the more controversial part of the recommendations, where it says that with any patient, you want to reassess pain and function. Be careful and avoid going over than 50 morphine equivalents. And avoid going greater than 90 without documenting the reason why. And so we're not saying you can't go over 50 or over 90, but you really need to be documenting what the reason is and if they're benefiting. We really want to avoid putting patients on opioids at these really high doses where they're really not getting benefit from the medication. So the other part they talked about, which was probably the more complex part, and many of you could agree in clinic, is what do you do with patients that have been on high-dose opioids and say they're stable, or maybe they're not doing well, but the opioids are helping them to a degree? Is that an easy 10-minute exam? No. Okay, so what they talked about specifically in the recommendations were to tapering opioids can be really challenging, especially if patients are on high doses. Do this in a non-judgmental manner, and you can do this in a very slow manner. In our state of Washington, if you inherit a patient on higher dose opioids, you get 3 months to do nothing but just to get to know the patient and reassess them. Okay, and then the recommendation is to try to do a tapering and a reduction in their medications. And in our patients, we may do 10% per month. We may wait a month to even consider doing a taper. But you really want to have that individual discussion with the patient in a plan and really do this in an empathetic way. And so they talked about very slow tapers. Many times you can do a taper for a month if the patients are having trouble. Maybe hold for 2 or 3 months to continue the taper. And we have some patients that they can't tolerate the taper, but we use other interventions, we get their pain under better control, and we can stabilize their doses in other ways. And so really this is a complex process, but you really need to be patient with your patients and not be forced to just start tapering patients because that can also lead to other problems. So really having a kind of an individualized treatment plan with your patients if you're gonna do these tapering. And having the resources to show those patients and give those patients other resources to do things. Many of our patients could benefit from psychology, exercise, other interventions. So maybe you would start those before you start a taper. So for our next patient is Mr. James. He's a 42-year-old technology salesman. He presents to his primary care with 4 days of severe back pain. It goes into his right leg. This happened after he was cleaning his garage and lifting heavy boxes. He's got severe lumbar pain shooting down his right buttock into his right heel. He tried over-the-counter ibuprofen, no change in pain. He can't work. He's got difficulty sitting more than 20 minutes. On his physical exam, he's got a decreased Achilles reflex. What muscle stretch reflex would that be? It's maybe S1, okay. He's got decreased light touch in the S1 dermatome down the back of his leg. So what are you thinking? If he has a dropped reflex, he has pretty significant nerve compression, okay? What are your options for this patient? So here are our choices. So what would you recommend for James? So if you can get your iPads out. One, education material about low back pain and the importance of staying active. Two, a steroid dose pack. Three, a prescription NSAID. Four, tramadol, 50 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours. Send him for an MRI of his lumbar spine. Start oxycodone 5 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours. Okay, so I'll give you a couple seconds to go through that question. Okay. Okay, so 52% said send for a lumbar MRI. So that may be accurate because he's got a kind of acute neurologic change. You could start other medications, right? Again, this is only going on for 4 days, but he's got significant weakness. The next group, 31%, said steroid dose pack. That's controversial. I mean, giving steroid dose pack would cause a reduction, hopefully, in the nerve root irritation, but that is a pretty large exposure of steroids to the body. So that could be considered, but it's somewhat controversial. And then a small percentage said prescription NSAIDs in starting tramadol. So this is 4 days. He's in severe pain, right? And he's got some acute neurologic complaints. That may be a little different than a patient presenting with axial low back pain. You may be more conservative and not go for an MRI for sure and do some more other interventions. Okay, so again, a complex case. What we wanted to talk about, there are different treatment guidelines for acute pain. This is an example of the Orthopedic Trauma Association's recommendations, and I'm going to go through three different areas. This is for musculoskeletal injuries first following a major procedure. Okay, so they break down inpatient, week one, week two, and three. The idea of how can we prescribe opioids to patients when they're sent home with other medications, and doing this in a reasonable way that we're going to prevent patients from needing long-term opioid use. And so they talk about week one, you could use non-opioids like ibuprofen, gabapentin, and titrate up to decrease sensitization. You could give scheduled acetaminophen, more of an analgesic dose of 1,000 milligrams. If you're going to use hydrocodone in the hospital, you try and hydrocodone or tramadol, and if you're going to discharge that person, giving them a very short supply. And the idea of not giving patients huge numbers of pills that they're not going to use, and then they're going to get in the hands of other recreational users and other kind of high-risk patients is going to be key. And in this recommendation, they actually break down over weeks two, three, and four, and this could be like a surgical patient, how you could taper down their medications. And so the idea is really giving kind of time-limited opioids if you're going to use it for this patient, and also combining the non-opioid interventions. So this is just for recommendations for a major surgery or procedure. The next group is for minor musculoskeletal injury. And so this, again, similar, using non-opioid medications. If you are going to use opioids, prescribing very small amounts for, say, 7 days at a time. And again, trying to limit progression into chronic opioid use, and really assessing patients in the short term to see if they're benefiting from the therapy. Okay. And the last was for non-operative musculoskeletal injuries. So that could be like a minor injury, like a small bone fracture, or a major injury, like a large bone fracture. Again, those patients may need opioids for acute pain, but again, giving small doses for short durations of time. How many of you have family members that have had elective surgery and they get medications to go home on? Do they use all of them? And they say, yeah, I had my knee scoped and I got like 90 oxycodone. Yeah. Do you think that's useful? Where do you think they put the medicines? In the medicine cabinet, right? And what happens to those medicines in the medicine cabinet? They could be stolen, they could be taken by kids, recreational users. Okay, so there's been a huge move to really limit this unnecessary prescribing of opioids, especially for minor injuries and even acute injuries. Okay, and these guidelines kind of help give you a little better idea of how you can do that and do that in a reasonable way. But the key is really balancing appropriate use of opioids as well as using those non-opioids as well. So again, related to that, you should be educating patients about where they store their medications. Medications you can be go to back to take back programs. Mm-hmm. Those were usually set up by the DEA. They were quarterly. Now many pharmacies, hospital systems have receptacles that patients can return their medications. And it's not just opioids, but any controlled substances. Okay, takebackmymeds.org is a website. You can type that in. You can put 10 miles, and it'll give you a radius of 10 miles from your home where these different take-back programs are. And so that's been a huge change and I think a huge improvement to really limit the effects of unused medications in the community. Okay, so the take-back programs are key. If you are going to dispose of medications, the FDA and DEA says that you should mix it, but don't crush in unpalpable substances, such as dirt, cat litter, or coffee grounds. Mm-hmm. Put them in a plastic bag and put them in the trash. Now, I'm in the state of Washington, and if you tell people to flush medicines down the toilet, what do you think they say? What? What are you talking about, right? Because there's this thought that we are going to be poisoning the sewage system, the water system. How do most of our patients excrete their opioids? Think about it, okay? So it's still probably safer if you don't have a take-back program. The FDA still says you should flush them down the toilet because that puts it at lower risk than having medications stay outside. And so in some areas, there's talk about flushing. In others, it's about take-back programs. But understand what's going on in your state and understand the resources you can give patients. All of our patients that are given a prescription opioid, we give them in their after-visit summary information about storage and disposal of their medicines. Okay, so now if we look back at Mr. James, and Mr. James, again, remember he was 42-year-old, he had the severe pain going down the leg, and you guys recommended the MRI. What about if the same patient presents to you, and he also tells you he's got a history of alcohol and prescription opioid use in his early 20s? He's in recovery, he's attending AA meetings, and now he develops pain. Okay, and I think here we still recommended the MRI, but would you look at him differently for his risks of being put on an opioid? Yes. Okay, so there's a couple different factors can change the way you're going to assess and treat a patient. Okay, so again, that's good social history, doing the ORT, doing a good, you know, assessment of depression and anxiety, and a substance use history is going to be key to really identify those patients earlier. So with that in mind, let's look back at our patient. What would you do for Mr. James now that he's told you he has a history of opioid addiction and alcohol abuse? Again, the same choices, one, educational material about low back pain and importance of staying active, steroids, prescription NSAIDs, tramadol, send for the lumbar MRI, or would you put them on oxycodone, 5 milligrams, max 4 per day? So no one told you life wasn't gonna be this way. Your job's a joke, you broke, your love life's DOA. So it changed a little bit. We had still sent in for the MRI, More choices here for prescription NSAID, use the anti-inflammatory, the higher dose to make sure you can try to decrease pain and quiet down sensitization. Okay, so we want to talk about setting the stage and managing expectations for patients. So education is going to be important. Okay, so what is for any recommendation for an intervention, if we get your pain down 1 or 2 points, I ask the patient, tell me 2 or 3 things you want to do. Have those individual patient goals with your patient and use those as your follow-up in how you're going to adjust their treatment. Okay, so I'm going to turn this back over to Mark.
How about just one question?
Okay.
A few years back, I went to a talk here that suggested no narcotics for non-cancer pain. Is that still true?
So the question was a statement about no narcotics or no opioids for non-cancer pain. I think opioids shouldn't be the first-line treatment, but like the CDC and other guidelines, if they are going to be used, they should be used with other interventions. And so really avoiding using opioids by themselves, but using them as part of a treatment plan and doing it for a trial. If the patients aren't doing well, you stop it, just like a trial you would do with any other medication. So we do think there needs to be balance, whether it's cancer pain or non-cancer pain, in trying to determine who's appropriate and who's not.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
There's a question for me, which was, can the increase in prescription and subsequent illicit opioid deaths be directly related to JCHO pain standards, including pain as the fifth vital sign? That's a whole lecture, but there is a great review on this subject by Teresa Rummins, which you can get from Mayo Clinic Proceedings, and basically her point of view was it's an unintended consequence, good intentions, and yes, the answer would be yes, that was one of the initiating factors. So for me, I've worked in this area for 40 years, and I've learned a bit. When you look at the brain, and the brain's the target for all drugs of abuse, and unfortunately for us, mu opioid pain medications are and have been become drugs of abuse. We look at the surface of the brain, we see gyri, and there are a couple of observations here. The first would be, you know, how long does it take for the brain to become fully gyrified? And that answer is gender specific. So in a female brain is fully gyrified by the age of 21. And for the male brain, it's probably never developed. But scientists do say at about 27 or 28. And most of the drug abuse interaction with developing brain is predicated on how long does it take for the brain to develop, and whether drugs taken in adolescence insinuate themselves and cause changes that are much different just based on the fact that the brain is still developing. For all drugs of abuse, they have one thing in common, and we've changed the definition. So what is a drug of abuse? A drug of abuse is actually defined as something that's self-administered in laboratory animals, typically rats, non-human primates, and there are even human self-administration laboratories. That self-administration is avid. It's an acquired drive that continues and could continue to death. The best death examples are, of course, you take 100 animals and divide them into two groups, and 50 get cocaine and 50 get opioids. The 50 on opioids self-administer them but end up on a maintenance program, and the 50 on cocaine hit the liver, and actually die by the end of 30 days. The opioid animals are alive, and the cocaine animals are not. All drugs of abuse, if you stick a micropipette in the nucleus accumbens, which will be shown here, the dopamine-rich cell body area from the ventral tegmental area through, here we go, the nucleus accumbens, we stick an electrode, an animal hits a lever, gets the drug, and dopamine is released in the nucleus accumbens. Every drug of abuse is like that. And then the effect goes mesocortical and then frontal, so that the frontal effects would be shown here in the next slide, but affect things like judgment, affect things like motivation. And part of the problem in addiction and in drug of abuse research is to explain why is it that a person can't calculate the risk of cigarette smoking or can't calculate the risk of continued use. And that is because the systems that are involved and essential for motivation and decision making are compromised. Drugs of abuse cause pleasure. And actually, I got interested in drugs of abuse as a proxy measure for pleasure and for pleasure system. I also worked in food and sex, which are harder to study. And again, in our brain here, we have a sad fact, which is the area of the brain that we study for drugs of abuse is quite primitive, is the most primitive. And we say it's phylogenetically stable, meaning that the pleasure system, in essence, is the same from rats to non-human primates to humans. And so with all of this great cortex, we can't and we don't have effective inhibition for the drives that are acquired early in life. And that's the bottom line understanding in addiction. And also, by the way, the pathway that inhibits this system and comes backward doesn't develop until very late in adolescence, if at all. Let's go to the slides. So, 40 years of work in the field, I've worked in self-administration, and basically all drugs, even by the way, medications that we use for obesity are tested for abuse potential using this model of self-administration, continued compulsive use, and then there's conditioning. So that anything that's around a drug event is conditioned onto it. So if you went to Woodstock, you might feel euphoric every time you hear Led Zeppelin. That's just the way it is. 510,000 deaths are anticipated on the basis of the current opioid crisis, and that no single policy would impact the crisis more than 4%, according to the artificial intelligence analysis done at Stanford University. They each can contribute, but we're in the midst of an opioid crisis, and even just last year's data, that the most recent death data shows a 4% decrease with tremendous efforts. The FDA has approved medications and for opioid use disorder, and of them, we've used them all, methadone, buprenorphine, naloxone, and naltrexone. They're should be used as part of a comprehensive assessment and treatment program, and they're safe and effective. They're underutilized, as we heard already, in part because people don't generally diagnose themselves and are waiting for both a diagnosis and an intervention. Some of the treatment programs that have been highlighted include the West Virginia program that was born out of the necessity of having large numbers of opioid deaths, large numbers of opioid use disorder patients, and an absolute dearth of trained practitioners and clinics. And this COAT program, the Comprehensive Opioid Assessment and Treatment Program, used community resources and MAT and has reported 1 and 3 year outcomes that are quite remarkable and worth looking at. And you can find that on the CME website. We did a program from the National Press Club on this program, a judicial program from the jail system in Connecticut, and a VA program with assessment in the VA hospital, and that's available. Naloxone's a kind of original treatment that we've used for overdose. Right now, the dose of naloxone keeps going up as the amount of drug purity has increased, and the FDA has approved an auto-injectable form that makes it widely available. There are some nuances to this, and that is that in the New England Journal recently, and in my own work about 2 years ago, we reported that many of the, quote, accidental overdoses were actually suicides. And that number is estimated at somewhere between 20 and 40% of the accidental overdoses are suicides, and they would require special treatment. So why don't you finish this up, and I'll go through the rest of the questions for you.
Okay. So from a SMART goal standpoint, so we want to make those goals specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. You want to prescribe precisely. We talked about just the significant variability from patient to patient, and remembering that pain is not just something in the periphery, it's not just a tissue trauma, but it can lead to sensitization of the nervous system, and so you and other changes. So you really want to be thinking about depression, anxiety, patient expectations, and all of those different factors when you're putting together a good treatment plan. You can screen patients. Remember, you can use things like the GAD-7 for anxiety, the PHQ-9 for depression. We introduced the opioid risk tool, which looks at those 5 risk factors for aberrant behaviors. So patients on opioids, maybe filling out one of those questionnaires and then basing your risk stratification on their scores, as well as maybe their morphine equivalent. Educate patients appropriately. And again, patients are a lot more open than we think about understanding about their pain. And so really spending the time learning some of the resources you can give patients that they can go home and kind of read and understand about pain and what's going on with their body is also going to be important. We mentioned about safe disposal and storage of medications. And again, you may be seeing this in your own rules in your states and from other guidelines as well. But really important to explain to patients. And remember, many of your patients you may be putting on an opioid just get one script. But giving them that information about safe storage and disposal is obviously going to be important. It's hoping to decrease the impact on communities that many opioids have unfortunately done in the negative. So we did talk about, that's not just one thing that's really going to work. And again, trying to think biopsychosocially, physical therapy, psychology, behavioral interventions, medications, exercise, mindfulness. There's so many other things we can do for our patients. And I think when you focus on multiple different areas from a treatment standpoint, you can shift away from this just being just opioids for their pain, because even in the best case scenario, it's only going to help them a short amount, and you really want to be careful with those patients. So that's kind of the summary. Thanks. Mark, did you want to add anything?
I want to add a lot of questions.
Okay.
Thanks everybody for asking so many questions. I have just way too many questions, of course. So Steve, if you would stay around after the program and have people come up and ask you, I'll go through them as much as I can. Someone said, did I understand you correctly that at least 20% of overdoses are actually suicidal? And yes, and that's a paper by a local University of Pennsylvania Chairman of Psychiatry and the Director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse that you can find in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Yeah, and I'll make a comment because that's great that you brought it up. There's some VA literature that showed the same numbers with increasing in suicides, and unfortunately, there's a huge increase in just the risk factor with chronic pain with suicide. And just patients with the thought of suicide, significantly greater numbers with patients with chronic pain. And many times those questions are never asked, which is important.
It's important because there was an assumption that opioid overdose was accidental until proven otherwise. And even in the last CDC guideline, they said when you rescue somebody with Narcan, it's important to get the context and the history,
right,
which I think is important. Do you think, after all of said and done and your talk, that we're under-treating pain because we're in the middle of an opioid epidemic?
So the question is, do we think we're under-treating pain in the midst of this opioid epidemic? I think there's two different healthcare challenges. On the one side, I never thought that opioids themselves should be used for pain. And so I think it's more of an opportunity that we really just have to take a step back and try to just do a better, more comprehensive approach with our patients. And so I kind of see it as an opportunity. And I think the public and our patients are more open to mind-body techniques. They're more open to exercise. There's obviously significant stigma about just taking opioids. Many of our patients on opioids want to be off opioids, or they're worried about some of the negative consequences. So I think it does give us an opportunity where maybe 10 years ago, it was a lot harder to talk someone into seeing a psychologist or going to physical therapy or doing some of these other interventions. So I do think it's an opportunity more that we have to do a better job of comprehensive pain care.
So some of the patients actually think they need their opioids and want their opioids, and you deny them that. Do we need like lessons in denial? I mean, do you like, is there a training program?
No, I think this is coming up, and especially about tapering patients, and there may be patients that are appropriate for opioids. We're not saying that those patients shouldn't continue, but really doing a good individual assessment. I know many clinicians are doing motivational interviewing to learn skills to help patients with tapers, because tapering can be very difficult. And again, some patients may be not able to tolerate a taper. They're on opioids. The opioids are helping their function. They're doing other interventions and other techniques to self-manage their pain. I think those patients are completely appropriate. So it's really kind of balancing out all those different issues with patients.
It's good that you mentioned the taper. The FDA today had an announcement, I think, on tapering. At least it came through while I was getting myself here. And it said the longer the better, keep the patient in mind and don't do anything acutely.
And I think what we've learned too is, the first thing you could, first seeing the patient is, we may just plan on a taper. I want to give you information about what our goals are going to be. When you come back for the next visit, we'll talk some more. The worst thing you can do is that first visit, start taking them off their medicines and doing that before you've even integrated other types of treatment. The other issue to remember with opioid tapers, and this is related to the suicides, is so many of these patients are on high-dose opioids for many years. If you decrease their opioids quickly, you may unmask undertreated depression or anxiety that was, in a sense, kind of controlled by the opioids, and that could cause other psychiatric problems. So you really want to be careful, get psychiatry involved, behavioral health involved as well. But you want to be careful with these rapid tapers. It is causing problems for patients. On the other side, we have patients we've taken off the opioids, and they just feel better. There's other side effects
Definitely. They
didn't realize they had, and they just feel better. They're learning other techniques. So again, you just need to balance that out.
Quick thing on your experience with ketamine.
So ketamine, there's actually recommendations came out for perioperative and for chronic management of ketamine. It's controversial, but there are recommendations. Those were done by Steve Cohen's group 2 years ago. In our own clinic, we do ketamine infusions for like 15 patients, where they get ketamine infusions for 2 to 3 hours, 2 days in a row. But we have very selected patients. There's a very narrow window with ketamine. And so again, I don't think it's for everybody. There are other interventions. From a mechanistic standpoint, the ketamine is thought to decrease central sensitization through the NMDA channel, so there's a mechanism. Ketamine has just been approved for depression. There's probably more evidence with depression than there is for chronic pain. But it is used in the hospital for opioid sparing. Patients are put on ketamine protocols that are on high-dose opioids and around the perioperative period, and that's been successful for some patients.
So there's a couple of questions about smoked cannabis and CBD.
For pain. I think that's for you. You're the addiction guy.
Well, you're the pain guy.
So I think, you know, this is also controversial. There's, you know, we have endogenous cannabinoids in our body that can decrease pain. It's still early with the development of those pharmaceutical brand products. I still think, you know, from a physician standpoint, it's still scheduled one on the DEA. I'm writing prescriptions. You're writing prescriptions with a scheduled, and so it's still an illicit substance. So we do not, as a common practice, have patients using marijuana as well as opioids. We usually have a plan for that. There's some evidence with some of the topicals in cannabinoid receptors that get downregulated in the skin. So I do think there's some evidence there, but I do think we really need to be careful until we can get a better understanding. And remember, the patients can still develop a substance abuse problem with cannabis, which I think is sometimes forgotten.
So there's a good JAMA review on the subject. It says, should cannabis be used? And their conclusion was no at this time. Our group had studied smoked cannabis, and that's probably what you're referring to. And it's really very interesting that what we've shown for smoked tobacco is the same for smoked cannabis. There's secondhand exposure. You can become addicted, actually, to secondhand smoke, and you can produce cannabinoid withdrawal by giving cannabinoid receptor antagonists. Some people may have used the old one that was a pharmaceutical on the market for a short time. I think they called it Ramona Band after the Ramones. But nevertheless, that produces cannabis withdrawal. I do think there's an interesting data emerging on some of the specialized CBDs. And when you do speak to colleagues in neurology, they'll say, well, it actually shows some promise in different percent. So right. I'd say leave it to the pharmaceutical companies to figure out what percent of each.
Yep.
Do you screen fibromyalgia patients for sleep apnea?
Well, I think many of our patients, we still ask the question about sleep apnea and their sleep quality. I think that's probably good that it was brought up. We see a lot of patients with chronic pain that are not sleeping well. Many times that's the first intervention we look at is helping them with sleep hygiene techniques, starting on non-benzodiazepine types of medications to help improve their sleep quality, and obviously, you know, looking at sleep apnea. I think the sleep apnea risk is especially with opioids, and it is not consistent. It's not predicted by the typical risk factors for sleep apnea, and so you really need to be careful because a number of studies have shown worsening sleep apnea on chronic opioids. In the past, we just thought that you became, you know, tolerant to that effect, but it's probably not true.
So, like, this is a more than one person asked this kind of question. When in your best practices, you listed psychological counseling and therapy and psychiatry and CBT, but they might not be reimbursed. How do you do that?
Well, I think, you know, most patients, we can refer to psychology, and we have a psychologist in our own clinic. We have integrated primary care clinics, behavioral health, counseling, social work, and psychology. So it's usually done through a different third-party group through their insurance benefit, but most patients can get time-limited cognitive behavioral therapy. And with the opioid epidemic, we're hoping that payers are going to start covering that. But it is an issue. I think what's key for you as providers is to identify in your region two or three psychologists that have an interest in treating patients with chronic pain, and then get familiar with them as kind of a referral relationship. But counselors, social workers can also get trained. We have physical therapists that are getting trained in CBT, kind of what's called psychologically informed physical therapy. So a lot of the therapists are doing mindfulness training in CBT as well. So it's evolving, and hopefully the insurance coverage is going to start to improve because that has been a problem for some of our patients.
I'm not going to get through all the questions. This was a particularly interesting question, of course, for me, because there's no answer, which is how long does it take for patients to become addicted to opioids? And that is a real question. There's even data looking now at wisdom tooth removal and what exposure to opioids might mean as far as the person's lifelong risk for an opioid use disorder if they were given high doses or any opioids for the wisdom tooth removal surgery. The interaction between the developing brain and opioid exposure is largely unknown, and we're just reacting to things. You could get the last one, which
okay.
is,
what it's could be we easy do? Question, right?
It is.
Right? Good job.
What could we do about ER docs because they so quickly prescribe opioids?
Well, again, I think the question is about emergency room doctors, and I know in our state, there's many of the ERs do not prescribe any opioids, or they're giving 3 days and 7 day limits, or they're communicating with the primary care physicians. In our state, they have to now, by law, check our prescription monitoring program for any opioids they prescribe. So I do think there's been more emphasis on trying to educate our emergency rooms to do a better job. Also, emergency rooms are giving out naloxone now, you know, and there's some clinics actually or emergency departments that are initiating buprenorphine in the hospital to take advantage of a person that comes in with an overdose that survived to get them started on buprenorphine. So I think there's been improvements. You know, it's not just the outpatient problem, it's the hospital, it's the emergency departments and the outpatient clinics that really need to do a better comprehensive job. So.
Well, I want to thank you for coming all the
Thanks,
way
Mark.
In and appreciate you doing
Thanks.
This. It's fun to be here with everybody and we'll stick around.
Appreciate yeah, thanks CME Outfitters. We hope you enjoyed the augmented
yep.
reality.
So.